we're going to be talking about a very unpopular subject, and that is death. We're going to be speaking about death tonight. And that's something that most people are very uncomfortable with. We don't want to face the fact that we are mortals, but I'm here to tell you tonight, you are going to die. You're going to, eventually. It might be tomorrow. It might be tonight. It might be 10 years from now. It might be 50 years from now. I don't know when, but I promise you, you are going to die. Something's going to happen. You might get a disease. You might get hit by a car. You might be in a car accident. You might get shot. You might have a heart attack. But whatever happens, I can promise you that you will die. Your days are numbered. And this is a fact that everyone has to face. British novelist William Boyd wrote this: "We all want to be happy, and we're all going to die." You might say these are the only two unchallengeable true facts that apply to every human being on this planet. We want to be happy, and we're going to die. Steve Jobs just died. One article reports, "The king is dead. Long live Steve Jobs." CRN reports, "Apple co-founder, chairman, former CEO, and messiah," I kid you not, "Stephen Paul Jobs is dead. Jobs was the guy who brought computing to the masses. Under Jobs' leadership, Apple returned to profitability. The iMac, iTunes, iPod, iPhone, and iPad completely transformed the computing landscape. Jobs was eccentric, brilliant, visionary, and mercurial." The term genius is badly overused these days, not least by the Apple stores, but it surely applies to Steve Jobs. In his way, he changed the world. You know, I've been astonished reading Twitter for the past 24 hours how much of an impact this man that most people never met, let alone saw twice a year maybe at some Apple convention, but how much he has impacted people's lives. He really did change the world in his own way. The Apple website says, "The world has lost an amazing human being. Those of us who have been fortunate enough to know and work with Steve have lost a dear friend and an inspiring mentor. His spirit will forever be the foundation of Apple." In August of this year, Steve Jobs announced that he was retiring due to his cancer. I remember the announcement. They said he was stepping down from Apple, and Apple stocks plummeted, and people started getting freaked out of what's going to happen to Apple without Steve Jobs. But no one really paid attention to the important part. He had cancer. And cancer generally leads to death. And several short months later, Steve Jobs did just that. He died. He once said, "Almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know how to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You're already naked. There's no reason not to follow your heart." Steve Jobs might have been a great man, but great men die. Steve Jobs might have changed the world, but people who change the world die. Steve Jobs might have had a lot of money, but people with lots of money die. Steve Jobs might have been loved, but people who are loved die. He said in 2005, "You can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, or whatever. Because believing that the dots will connect down the road will give you the confidence to follow your heart. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life." Jobs said two interesting things there, and we need to realize that tonight. Number one, remember that you'll be dead soon. You need to understand that tonight. You need to realize you'll be dead soon. You say, "Well, Nate, I'm young. I'm in college. I've got years ahead of me." Guess what? In the scheme of eternity, 50 years goes by in the blink of an eye. You will be dead soon. And you need to understand that. Number two, he said that you have to trust in something. You have to trust in something. Well, I'm here to tell you tonight, not just something. You don't have to trust in karma, not destiny, not life, and certainly not your gut. Unless you trust in Jesus Christ, unless you remember that you'll be dead soon and make the biggest choice of your life by accepting Him, unless you do that, there is no hope. Being a great man or a woman will not help you. This is a harsh reality that we all have to deal with. Death is no respecter of persons. It matters not if you're a billionaire or the poorest of poor. If you're an old person or sometimes a very young person. You might be a president, a king, a queen, a movie, or a rock star. Eventually, everyone dies. And that's true. Death is unavoidable. Has a 100% fatality rate. Only those who are prepared to die are really prepared to live. So my question for you tonight is, are you prepared to die? If you were to walk out of this room tonight and you were to get hit by a car, would you be ready? Would you be prepared? Would your heart be settled before the Lord? Would you have your things in order? Would you be ready to go? Or would you find yourself, that person at the end of an altar call, saying, next time. Next time I'll give my heart to Jesus Christ. If I can only do this before I accept Christ, then next time I'll do it. When I get a family, when I get a wife, when I get a husband, when I have kids, when I have that job, then I'll accept Christ. We're not promised then, we're promised now. Are you prepared to die now? There's a tombstone in England with these words on it. Pause now, stranger, as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you will be. So prepare for death and follow me. Are you prepared to die? If not, I'll tell you how to be in a little bit. If you don't feel ready to die, I'll give you the chance to be ready by the end of this teaching. But we wonder, why do we have to die? If God is so loving, if God is so good, why do we have to die? What's up with that? Why do we only have a certain amount of time on this earth? Well, long ago in a garden called Eden, a guy named Adam and a girl named Eve ate the forbidden fruit. And God said to him, in that day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die. But Adam did. And when Adam took a bite of that fruit, it was the bite heard and felt around the world. And it continues in its repercussions to this very day. So who do you have to thank for your death that will come someday? Well, your great-great-granddad and grandma, Adam and Eve. That is who is to blame for death. But can I just say, I'm happy that we die, because this world isn't all that great. This world isn't all that awesome. Even for people who have a lot of money, there's not a lot of hope in the future. Because really, what's going to happen to it? It's all going to burn in the end. It's all going to rust. It's all going to break. It's all going to be lost or fade away. And in reality, this world isn't that great. But knowing that we're going to die, we can know something else. And that is that we're going to have a future in an eternal place, which is either heaven, which is a good thing, or hell, which is a bad thing. We can know, because of the fact that we know we're going to die, that there is a future. When Adam took that bite, as I said, we felt the repercussions. And with that bite came many problems like sickness and death. Romans 5:12 says, therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men because all sinned. Up until that point, we would have lived forever in that perfect body. We would have never died. The intention was to live forever in a perfect place. But now, because of that, these bodies wear out. They break down with the passing of time. And that's because these bodies that you and I live in were not meant to last forever. They're temporal at best. The real us, the spark, that personality that gives each of us our uniqueness is not our bodies, it is our soul. You know, I think it's safe to say that the older you get, the worse you look. Now, there is like that age where like you hit a plateau and you're like, all right, I'm the best that I'm ever going to look now. And then from there, it's downhill. And that age really varies. For some people, it's in the 20s. For some, it's in the 30s. You know, a few people like Brad Pitt status, it's in their 40s. But there comes an age where everyone hits a plateau where it's all downhill from there. And I'm thankful that our bodies are temporal, because I would not want to be, you know, 105 with nasty, saggy skin and wrinkles all over the place and just looking gross. I'm glad that we've got, you know, 70 or 80 years, because after that, it doesn't look too good, man. So, you know, our bodies are temporal. They're not meant to last forever. Your spirit, your soul, that will last forever. That will live forever. Your body will not. So what happens when death takes place? What happens when you die? Well, Jesus answers that question for us here in John 5, verse 25 to 29. Let's read it together. Jesus says, "Most assuredly I say to you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son to have life in himself, and has given him authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation." Let's stop there. There's three important truths that strike us from this text. Three things that will happen when you die. Number one, you need to know that death is not the end of existence. Death is not the end. Death is just the beginning, in the words of a famous mummy movie. Number two, there is a final judgment. Death is not the end, and there is a final judgment. You, at some point in your life, or I guess your death, will face a judgment. Whether you're a Christian or a non-Christian, you will face a judgment. And number three, there are two forms of existence beyond the grave, and the kind of existence that we will enter into depends on your relationship with Jesus Christ. Let's look at our first point. Death is not the ending. Verse 25 to 26, read it again with me. Jesus says, "Most assuredly I say to you, the hour is coming and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted to the Son to have life in himself." Steve Jobs once said, "No one wants to die. Even people who want to go to heaven don't want to die to get there. And yet death is the destination we all share." 400 years before the birth of Christ, the renowned Greek philosopher Socrates drank the poison hemlock and he lay down to die. And his friends asked him, "Shall we live again?" And the dying philosopher could only respond with, "I hope so, but no one can know." That's not true. You can know that you will live again. As a matter of fact, it's a fact that you will live again. If you're a Christian, you will live again. But guess what? If you're a non-Christian, you will also live again. It's just going to be a lot worse than it is now. See, for a Christian, death is only the beginning and it just gets better. For the non-believer, it just gets worse. For a non-believer, this is the best time, and you better live up the 80 years you have, because after that, it's tough toast, buddy. And that's the truth. You can know that you will live again. But it's hard for us to recognize that these human bodies simply will not live forever. You know, people are still searching for that elusive fountain of youth. Throughout centuries, people have tried to find ways to not die. You know, you have crazy things now like cryogenically freezing your body. You know, that's great. Maybe you can find a way to freeze your body and then 100 years from now you can cure that disease. But guess what? You're still going to be ugly and frostburnt. So why do you really want to live again? You know, people are constantly searching for ways to make themselves immortal. I read recently that roughly 1 in 3 adults under the age of 50 is now shopping for unconventional medical treatments. They are spending more than $10 billion a year in hopes that their efforts will act as a sort of additional insurance, guaranteeing them a much extended state of wellness. People are trying to find ways to live again, and to be honest, it's a waste of money, because whether you like it or not, you're going to. So why are you trying to make the life here longer when you already know there's something else ahead? The truth is that there is plenty that comes after this life on earth. So the question is, what will happen beyond the grave? If we know that death is not the ending, what comes after death? Well, that brings us to our second point, and that is that judgment is impending. Look at verse 27. Jesus tells us, "And has given him the authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man." At the end of death, every human being will face something, and that is a judgment. We will be judged for the decisions that we have made, for the choices that have played out within our lives, for the things we've said, for the things we've done, and most importantly, for the knowledge of asking Jesus Christ to either come into our lives or failing to do so. Acts 17:30 says, "Truly these times of ignorance God overlooked, but now commands all men everywhere to repent, because he has appointed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he has ordained. He has given assurance to this to all by raising him from the dead." 2 Peter 2:9 says, "The Lord knows how to rescue godly men from trials and to hold the unrighteous for the day of judgment while continuing their punishment." Matthew 12:36 says, "But I say to you, for every idle word men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment." Now this can scare you if you're not living the way you should, or this can excite you. I don't know about you, but the fact that there is a future judgment should assure us that ultimately God is fair. You know, we like things to be fair. I remember when I was a kid, if I were to watch a movie where the good guy would die, I would get really frustrated. I would get really mad and like vindictive. I would say, "I want to kill that guy." And I would watch Bambi and I would see the hunter kill Bambi's mom. And I'd say horrible things. "I hope a deer gorges that guy. You know, I hope that guy gets what he deserves. That's not fair. Why does Bambi's mom have to die so a family of hunters can eat for the winter? Not fair, not cool." You know, I would always get angry. I remember at a very young age, and don't hate my mom for this. She's a good mom. She really is. But when I was about 10 or 11, my mom took me to see Last of the Mohicans. I don't know why any mom would take a 10-year-old kid to see that movie. But I remember going to that movie with my mom and with my grandma and watching it, and watching the scene where the good guy falls from the cliff and he gets beat with a club. And I remember in the middle of the theater screaming and saying, "This is a stupid old lady movie. I hate this." And getting so frustrated. Why? Because it wasn't fair. It wasn't fair. You know, as a little kid, everything has to be fair. Hey, you can have this toy for 5 minutes, but then I get it for 5 minutes because that's fair. Hey, you can have this much of the candy, but I get this much because that's fair. Right? Kids have a very defined sense of justice. And if things don't play out in that just spectrum of their mind, it is not okay. But God is fair. And that should make you happy. That should make you joyful that God is fair. This teaching of future judgment should satisfy our inward sense for a need of justice in the world. Imagine if there was no justice, how rampant crime would be. Now, play that out spiritually. If there were no justice for doing something wrong, well, then how is that fair? If there is a God, and by looking at ourselves, our bodies, by looking at creation, we can deduce that there is a God, we have to deduce two things. And I heard this, I'm actually stealing this, from a guy who tried to convince me to give him $500. No joke, we were just in San Diego, and a guy walked up to me and Jesse Lusco and a couple of my other friends, and he said, "Hey, do you guys want to become millionaires?" "Yeah." "Well, give me $500, and I can promise you that in 5 years, you will have $1 million. And he tried to pitch us this whole thing, and my buddy Jesse is the boldest evangelist I've ever met. And he started just preaching the gospel to him, just sharing the love of Christ. And in the process of doing so, this guy said that he came to a position several years back where he had to believe in God, that he looked at creation, he looked at himself, and he said, "I had to believe that there was a God." And he said this, and I quote, "I realized that if there was a God, a couple things had to be true. Number one, God would have to be a God of truth. Because if God exists, if he is true, then he has to be a God of truth. And number two, I deduced that he had to be a God of love." And this was coming from someone who didn't read the Bible, someone who wasn't a believer, and yet in 5 minutes, he deduced two of the great truths of the Bible, that God is truth and that God is love. And that God of truth and that God of love is a just and a fair God. And it's because of his love and it's because of his truth that he judges sinners. You know, we've all seen things that seem so unjust. We've seen horrible crimes. We've seen wicked actions. And we can often say to God, how can they get away with that? How can you let them get by with that? Man, if we only had Grisham from CSI and he could find that guy and get what he deserves. Why can't God be like that? Why can't God give people the justice that they deserve? But know this, God is in control and he keeps very accurate records. God keeps very accurate records, and we're going to see that in a moment. Colossians 3:5 says, for the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong that he has done, and there is no partiality. Listen, every wrong in the universe will ultimately be paid for. Every sin will ultimately be paid for. Your sin will ultimately be paid for. You're a sinner. That shouldn't come as a shock to you. Really? I didn't realize that. You're a sinner. And your sin will ultimately be paid for. Either it will turn out to have been paid for by Jesus Christ when he died on the cross, where you repent of your sins and put your faith in him, or your sin will be paid for in the final judgment for those who do not trust in Jesus for salvation. God is just. God is fair. And we must leave in his hands those who have wronged us. Those who have slandered and lied about us, those who have tried to destroy us. We have to understand that one, death is not the ending, and number two, judgment is impending. And that brings us to our third and our final point. This is where we're really going to spend our time, and that is that your fate is depending. Look at verse 28 to 29. Paul, I almost said Paul, we've been in Romans now for a year, so Jesus says, that's a lot better, a lot more authority in that than Paul. Do not marvel at this. For the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth. Those who have done good to the resurrection of life and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. I want to take you to another passage really quick that will deal with this more in depth. Turn to Revelation chapter 20 with me. Revelation chapter 20, verse 4 through 6, give us a much more clear and vivid picture of what this means. Revelation 20, verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness of Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead did not live again until 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. According to the Bible, there are two resurrections. You know, we often think that, okay, when we die, it's just all a resurrection, and it's all, boom, up there. But there's two resurrections. The resurrection of the just and the unjust. The resurrection of the good and the evil. And which resurrection you experience is depending on the decision that you make on earth. Your fate in eternity is depending on what decision you make on earth. The first resurrection is the one that all true believers will experience. If we are a believer, meaning we have put our faith in Jesus Christ, we go immediately into the presence of Jesus Christ. There's no layovers. It's a direct flight. You know, I hate layovers. And, you know, my buddy Robbie C. just said he was from Texas. And I think he said Houston. Is that right? Yeah. Well, I hate flying through Houston, to be honest. I hate it. I hate flying through Houston or Dallas because for some reason, every time I do, I have a layover there, I get stuck. Something happens. And it's not all the time Texas's fault, but it can be weather somewhere else. But for some reason, that's always where I get stuck. And you know, I know how to get across the sky bridges. I know what restaurants are in different places. I know where the Bose store is so I can go try out those cool headphones. I know where all the stuff is. And I hate it. It's like living in transit, and you're just kind of miserable. You're stuck waiting to hear a voice from heaven come through the speakers and say that your flight is now at this gate, and you have to get all your stuff and run really fast over there. No one likes layovers. Well, with death, there's no layovers. It's a direct flight. There's no purgatory that many speak of. 2 Corinthians 5:8 says, "We are confident, I say, and would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So we make it our goal to please him, whether we are at home in the body or away from it." We're told there, Paul says that if we are in our body, well, then we're here. But if we're out of our body, then we are with the Lord. There's no other place where you could be. Well, you're either in your body with the Lord or you're at Denny's. No, you're either in your body or you're with the Lord. Paul also spoke of his dilemma where he longed to be in heaven with Jesus, and yet he knew that there was work yet to do for him. He spoke of departing to be with Christ, which is far better. Notice he did not say, depart for a few hundred or thousand years in a state of suspended animation until all your sins are paid for, and then you'll be with Christ, which is far better. No, he says to depart to be with Christ. It's immediate. As Jesus said to the thief on the cross, today you will be with me in paradise. You know, it's important to note that when the Christian dies, they will ultimately stand before a judgment seat as well. You know, we oftentimes think that it's just the non-believers that will be judged, but we will be judged too. Not a judgment like non-believers will face, which we'll look at in a second. Not a judgment that will determine whether or not we're allowed to come into heaven, but rather a judgment where God gives rewards for our faithfulness with the gifts and abilities that God gave to us on this earth. We will face that judgment. We're told in 2 Corinthians 5:8, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad." Romans 14:10 says, "We shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. Each of us will give account of himself to God." We need to recognize that our very lives, including our time, our resources, and our talents, and our gifts, belong to God. That means that every one of us should be seeking to glorify the Lord with what God has given to us. But what about the non-believer? We're going to face a judgment based on how we use the name of God. But what about the non-believer? What happens to them? Well, just as surely as the Christian goes into the presence of God in heaven, the non-believer goes to a place of judgment as well. Jesus described this in vivid detail in the story of Lazarus and the rich man, where they both went to different places. And the second resurrection speaks of that day when they will stand before God at the great white throne. And at this point, it's far too late to change anything. When the non-believer dies, when they stand before that judgment seat of Christ, there's no do-overs. There's no second chances. There's no, oh, hey, well, now that I see you on that white throne, I believe in you. No, once you make your choice here on earth, you live with that choice for eternity. Revelations 20:11 through 15 touches on that. We're in Revelation 20:11. It says, "Then I saw a great white throne, and him who sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged according to their works by the things which were written in the books. The sea gave up the dead who were in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them, and they were judged, each one according to his works. Then death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire." In verse 12, we're told that both small and great were before this great white throne. Remember, God is no respecter of persons. Many people who will stand before this throne will be kings, queens, emperors, presidents. No one will be exempt. But I want to point out that only non-believers will be here. Only people without a relationship with Christ will be here. John 3:18 says, "He who believes in me is not condemned, but he who does not believe in me is condemned already because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son." So question, if the unbeliever is already condemned, then what purpose is the last judgment? Well, the purpose of this final confrontation between God and man is to clearly demonstrate to the non-believer why they are condemned. Think of it this way. If you have a kid and your kid does something bad, you don't just run over and smack him in the face. And they look at you like, what? You tell them, hey, because you made a mistake, because you did this, I have to spank you. And then they'll throw in that this hurts me so much more than it hurts you. Oh, no, it doesn't. It's going to hurt them a lot worse. But you explain to them why they're getting punished. That's basically what the Great White Throne Judgment is all the unbelievers stand before God, and I feel like they have the oh crap face on. Oh man, you mean all this was real? You mean this is really happening? And then God gets to tell them, hey, you're about to get punished, and this is why. And he reads from these books. Perhaps the book that he reads from would show how we fail to live up to our own standards. Romans 2:15 says, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts, well, accusing or else excusing one another, in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. Another book that might be read would be the book of the law, the righteous requirements of the law. The law condemns, but it does not convert. It challenges, but it does not change. It points the finger, but it does not give mercy. The law is simply a preparation for the gospel, which is the provision. According to the law, all are guilty. Another book that might be read at that great white throne might have the record of all the times that you've heard the gospel and pushed it away. And knowing that that knowledge brings responsibility. Then in verse 12, we're told, and I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to their works by the things which were written in the books. I want you to imagine for a second that you're standing before the great white throne. The nail-scarred hand of Jesus Christ scans through the book, but your name is not found there. As you're standing there before Jesus, you begin to tremble and you say, Lord, Lord, did I not prophesy in your name? Did I not cast out many demons and perform many miracles? Lord, didn't I go to church? Lord, didn't I memorize John 3:16? Couldn't I sing Amazing Grace? And the Lord's response will be, depart from me. I never knew you. I never knew you. Imagine that. Standing before Jesus Christ, realizing all the opportunities you had to accept him, and then being faced with that news that he never knew you because you hadn't truly accepted him with your heart. These words will ring in that condemned person's ears for all of eternity. And can I say that perhaps the reason that believers won't be present is that we would not be able to bear hearing our mom or dad have that said to them. Depart from me, I never knew you. Hearing our best friend, our brother, our sister, our loved ones face that judgment, realizing all the times, all the opportunities we had to confront them with the gospel, and yet we didn't because we were what? Too scared to tell them what Jesus Christ did for their sins? Hearing a loved one say, why didn't you warn me of this judgment? Why didn't you tell me about Jesus Christ's forgiveness? And then perhaps this is a record of everything that we've ever said or done. Matthew 12:36 says, but I say to you that for every idle word that men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. Imagine for a second every sin that you've ever committed since you were a little kid. All the things you're ashamed of, you're embarrassed of, that you don't want anyone else to know about. Now take all those sins and place them with all the sins of everyone else in this room. Add those to the sins of this city, this country, that this world has committed. Jesus knows what those are. Adam's apple, Cain's murder, Noah's drunkenness, Abraham's doubt, David's adultery, Samson's lust, Jonah's running, Uzziah's pride, Judas's betrayal, Peter's denial, all the way to the very guards hammering 9-inch metal stakes into Jesus Christ's hands. Then he moves forward. Every Jew Adolf Hitler burnt, every baby aborted, every marriage vow broken, every lie told, every porno purchased, every dollar stolen, every wife beaten, every child molested. These sins are all written down and kept track of. But they can be forgiven. Jesus Christ took every sin ever committed onto his shoulders. He tasted death for us. Verse 15, we're told in Revelation 20, and anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. Born once, die twice. Born twice, die once. If you don't accept Jesus Christ, if you're not born again, the first death is the best one. If you don't have Christ in your heart, you're facing a second death, which is far worse. But if you have Jesus Christ in your heart, if you've been born again, then guess what? It just gets better. There's no second chances at the second death. Death is coming, and we determine where we will spend eternity by our decision to follow or not follow Jesus Christ. You know, death is a fearful thing for a non-believer, but you only get one chance. If you die without accepting Christ, you've made your choice. At that point, it's far too late to change anything. You know, I've been looking for the past 24 hours on Twitter since Steve Jobs has died, and it's sad. It's sad to read the tweets. People, and Christians even more, are saying things like, "Rest in peace, Steve." "We're praying for you, Steve." Not praying for his family, we're praying for you, Steve. "You changed the world, Steve. God bless, Steve." Now, I want to say, I don't know what Steve Jobs' heart was like before the Lord. I don't know if he accepted Jesus Christ or not, and I believe that we should pray for his family. But if Steve Jobs did not accept Christ into his heart, he will not rest in peace. If Steve Jobs did not ask Jesus Christ into his heart, praying for him won't do anything. It doesn't matter if he changed the world or not. Only Jesus Christ can save. See, once you die, it's too late. Those prayers should have come not when he died, but when he lived. When you face death, which you will you do so like the renowned atheist Voltaire, who cried out with desperation, "I am abandoned by God and man. I will give you half of what I am worth if you will give me 6 months of life. O Christ, O Jesus Christ." Or will you face death like the believer Stephen, who, as he was being stoned to death, said, "Look, I see the heavens opened and Jesus the Messiah standing beside God at his right hand." Or like D.L. Moody, who on his deathbed said, "I see earth receding and heaven is opening. God is calling me." I close with how I began. Death is no respecter of persons. Doesn't matter if you're a billionaire or if you're the poorest of poor. An old person or a young person, a president, a queen, a movie, a rock star, a king, eventually everyone dies. The king of pop, Michael Jackson, is dead. The king of rock, Elvis Presley, is dead. The king of grunge, Kurt Cobain, is dead. And now the king of computers, Steve Jobs, is dead. He might have created the iPod, the iPhone, the iTunes, the iPad, the iMac, and he might have even created iLife. But even with iLife, he died. But Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, is alive forevermore. And he waits with open arms for anyone who will trust in him, so that when death comes, and yes, it comes, he will welcome you into his presence. Are you ready? Are you ready right now to die? Do you have that hope? Do you know that you'll go to heaven when you die? Don't tell me you're a good person, because you aren't. You say, "Well, you don't know me, Nate." You're right, I don't know you. Probably a good thing I don't. But God does. And God says, "There is none righteous, no, not one." That's God's evaluation of you, not mine. And luckily for you, heaven is not a place for good people. Heaven is a place for forgiven people. Only forgiven people will get to heaven, and only unforgiven people will go to hell. So the question is, how can you be forgiven? By coming to Jesus Christ. By saying, Lord, I'm sorry for my sin. I turn from it, and I put my faith in you and you alone to save me. Have you done that yet? If not, would you like to? What if this were your last night on earth? Because you don't know when life is going to end, but you know the Lord. And if you know the Lord, you don't have to worry about it. Do you want to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that when you die, you will go to heaven? The Bible says, prepare to meet your God. Heaven is a prepared place that Jesus prepared for us. And it's for prepared people.